attention, Limerick. Have you seen my dog? Mauler, a foxy Tibetan bull mastiff wolf whippet mix went missing from my yard at 9 o'clock this morning. Last seen driving a black OD and clearing a group of small fellas out of it in a little car park. We are heartbroken as a family and terrified. Mauler is a dote of a dog, but he also has severe behavioural issues since coming off the drink. Do not try and talk to him, you won't get through to him. And if you're wearing black or white items of clothing, don't go near him. He'll take you for a piebald horse and go for your throat. If you have any information about my dog, don't hesitate to contact me, John Murphy. I'm John Murphy, right? Via Donny Scott Solicitors. Mauler is more than just a member of my family. He's also the owner of my car and godfather to my child. Mauler, if you're listening, please come home. Okay, let's bring my bastard home.
Because this is an episode about special effects, do you have any party pieces or any hidden talents?
I can make my shoulder blades kind of pop out of my back.
I think that's called a disability.
You know, what's yours?
I can do impressions, and one of my impressions is Tangina from the Poltergeist, you know, the little woman.
Yeah, I do, yeah. I'd love to hear it.
Okay, so here we go. Here we go.
Caroline! Caroline!
I'll use small words that you'll be sure to understand, you warthog-faced buffoon.
What you just said is one of the most insanely idiotic things I have ever heard. Everyone in this room is now dumber for having listened to it.
What did you say?
You are a sad, strange little man.
Don't call me stupid.
Hello, and welcome to The Best Bits, a movie podcast. I hate the way I say hello. hello. It's like, hello, hello.
You just hate greeting people in general. It's just like, what?
What's wrong with you? What's wrong with you? Hello and welcome. I can't do it. This is where I'm going to struggle now. Okay, head in the game. Hello and welcome to the best. Stop it, Will.
Kevin lost ability. What's wrong with you? I can't say.
Hello.
I can't say.
Hello and welcome to The Best Bits, a movie podcast where each week we pick our favourite scenes from randomly selected, weirdly specific themes. This is your co-host Kevin, a writer of one and a bit films and three and a bit episodes of TV, and I'm joined once again by my co-host of three films and a Christmas special, Will Collins. That has to be fine.
That is absolutely it. You've nailed it. I'm not going to reveal the fact that it's taken you at least seven efforts to get to get over that, but you did it. You got there. I'm so proud of you.
Thank you. That means a lot. This is why you need special effects supervisors to make things look good on set. So, Will, this week, we hope that we've got new listeners joining us again. So we're going to need to catch them up and fill them in on what the premise of the show is and what we do here each week. So take it away.
Yeah, I'll take it away.
And shoot it.
Take it around the back of the shed and shoot it. And what we have is that we basically every week we randomly select a topic from a big wheel, and these topics vary from action scene to best sex scene to musical scene and everything in between. And it's kind of great, Kevin, because this is our first time recording an episode after we actually have launched our first episode, after our first episode has gone out into the podcast verse. Isn't it mad?
It is, and we're 2 months ahead, and we want to stay 2 months ahead because we're scared of what people are going to do to us if they catch up to us.
Yeah, I'm just delighted that I've confirmed that you're not a voice in my head, and I'm coming up here and just talking to myself, and people are confirming that because people are listening, which is great. I'm not insane.
I've got bad news for you, Will. This is a voice in your head. I'm the devil on your shoulders.
What?
This is all part of your therapy. So this week we're We're dealing with SFX scenes, special effects scenes. And I don't know about you, Will, but when I was like looking into the history of the special effects and sort of trying to figure out, you know, where am I going to land in the pantheon of great practical effects, this is going to be, I think, another nostalgia sort of heavy episode, because the stuff that's like done in camera on the day, that stuff is like, it's from our childhood again. It's like the 80s, the 90s and everything before the advent of like CGI came in. Yeah. So this is one of these topics where this to me is what drew me into the movies more than anything. It was like the movie magic moments. It was like stuff where you felt like a film set was a magical place where, you know, literal magicians were at work.
Hello, I'm Steven Spielberg.
What was that show? There was a making of
Movie Magic.
Movie Magic. Yeah.
You see, for over 100 years, filmmakers have been using sound stages like this to create the stuff that dreams are made of. Special effects, astonishing moments, movie magic. They don't just tell a story. They thrill, they dazzle, sometimes even startle. But done well, they never fail to take you a breath away.
Yeah, movie magic. And I think there was another one called Lights, Camera, Action. I think it was shows you tune in on a Sunday evening and watch movie magic and see how they did, how they blew up like the White House for Independence Day, or how they made the bus jump the bridge in Speed.
Well, one of the amazing effects, you know, one of the amazing effects that still stands out to me and was one that really impressed me very early on was the skeleton battle scene in Jason and the Argonauts. Got actors on set fighting a squadron of these stop motion skeletons, which have been created in miniature, like, you know, in miniature form and matched to the actors on set. And oh my god, it's like still to this day, like over 60 years later, it's incredible. And that was all animated by one guy, Ray Harryhausen.
It is incredible because it's the ingenuity and it's sort of the craftsmanship. This sounds like fanciful and like, you know, where you're scripting your own life and stuff. But going to see Jurassic Park.
Boy, no, I hate being right all the time.
And obviously Jurassic Park just being Jurassic Park, just an incredible film that marries visual effects and special effects with like massive big animatronics and great CG for the time that still stands up to this day and works. Yeah. But I remember walking out of the cinema, and you know, back in those days, like the Capital Cinema in Cork, which has become like a character, recurring character in this podcast. But you'd have to queue up for like 2 hours to get in. But you'd have this very slow sort of like trudge out of the cinema where it's like disembarking a plane, packed out. And I remember walking up the aisle slowly, the music is playing behind me and thinking, what age was I? I must have been 11 or 12. But I was thinking to myself, I want to do that. I want to do that, whatever that is, I want to do that. I've been obsessed with films, you know, throughout my childhood, but that was the moment where I felt, no, it's done, it's a done deal now, I have to do that.
I had the exact same moment of epiphany, but it was at home watching Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom and the opening scene in the Obi-Wan nightclub. And it was the first time I watched a sequence where I realised, you know, when Indiana Jones goes behind the bad guys are shooting at him, and he goes behind this big, large ornamental shield, and he grabs a sword and he like cuts the ropes and drops down, and they start firing, and the bullets start dinging off the shield, and the shield rolls across the nightclub. I remember having a moment of epiphany where I realized that this just wasn't all made up on the day, that it was, you know, that people were behind it, and I remember just having that exact moment where I used those words. Today I used that word, or I went, I want to do that. Whatever that is, I want to do that.
Wow, holy smoke! Crash landing!
Short round, step on it.
So we ended up becoming screenwriters, which, you know, nobody should want to do that. Yeah. That's
something. The least sexy. No one's making documentaries. Behind the scenes documentaries of us hunched over keyboards. It's not happening.
For me, special features on DVDs got really boring when The documentaries became about guys hunched over desks, pointing their mouse and saying, we did this and we did that, which is basically what writing is. But it's also the thing like with special effects where they're the things which can be a real barrier for newer generations to accept. You sort of look at it and you think, that's fake, that's mock, and it doesn't feel real. But I have a different reaction to that, which is sometimes something can look fake and you know it's not real. You know it's like a guy in a suit or what have you. But you know there's sort of an artistry to it, that something's been created, and you sort of have a reaction to the actual creation itself.
There's texture, and there's that kind of verisimilitude to it.
So what are the ones, Will, that popped into your head when you were thinking about this?
Jason Argonauts was one that immediately popped into my head. But another one that's kind of like, of course, it's obviously tinged with nostalgia, but I have to go to Labyrinth.
You remind me of the babe.
What babe?
Babe with the power.
What power?
Power of voodoo.
Voodoo?
You do.
They're what?
Remind me of the babe.
I think the practical effect works and effects work in that is incredible, and particularly the creation of the little goblin character, Hoggle.
I'm Hoggle.
Do you know where the door to the labyrinth is?
Oh, maybe.
Well, where is it?
Like, that was an astounding achievement. Like, it took 5 people to bring that character to life.
Yeah, it just feels like it's a guy wearing prosthetics, not sort of like a puppet that's got all this sort of like machinations behind the face and stuff.
You know, you talk about a younger generation kind of poo-pooing, you know, all the older stuff, but Hoggle, the creation of Hoggle's character, still stands to this day. It holds up its quality. You feel that that's a real goblin.
That's what I thought.
There was one person, obviously a small actress inside, doing the physical performance of the arms and legs and the head movement, but then to the doing the actual eyes and all that sort of stuff. Like, there was 4 different performers doing all that, and they all, every one of them, all those 5 performers had to rehearse and work in synchronicity to kind of like make the line sell perfectly and give that character life and breathe life into it. And it was all done like in camera. The performance was happening right there with the voice actor as well. The voice actor was the person who was operating the actual, his mouth, we'll say, you know? So for me, that was one.
Yeah.
I'm still blown away at how the craftsmanship and the kind of the synergy of all these performers that have to do it live in camera. I absolutely love it. I think it's brilliant. It's a fantastic film. And a fantastic kind of like practical effect. I have another pick, Ron Howard's Apollo 13.
This is Houston. Say again, please.
Houston, we have a problem.
Specifically, the practical effect about that I love is that to create the illusion of them being in zero gravity, you know, up in their space shuttle, is they went and they created a set inside the Vomit Comet, which is a plane they used, that NASA uses to train astronauts how to deal with, you know, zero gravity. And I, you know, again, it's one of those things that I watched the actual raw footage of them on set, and they only had like 15 seconds, but like for those 15 seconds, everything is in zero gravity, and it had to happen in camera right then and right there. For me, I just go, oh man, wouldn't that have been brilliant?
I don't think you'd be invited on set as a writer, Will.
I don't think so. I think I might be a hazardous object to have.
But yeah, that's the stuff where you'd watch it as a kid and you'd think, like, that's magical. I want to be on that set. I want to make movies. I want to experience that.
And another thing about those shots is that the camera, not only are the actors in zero gravity, but the actual camera people and the camera itself is in zero gravity. So it creates a natural, there's a handheld natural zero gravity camera being used. And they've never done it before like this. So like, you know, it's not like a locked camera, but so the cameraman is literally just holding onto it by one little handle at the end as it floats around the place and just grabs it before gravity kicks back in again after 10 seconds. And it just, that's amazing. And that's why for me, Apollo 13 is still one of the best films set in space, because of the reality of what they managed to achieve using practical effects and movie magic.
Hello, Houston. This is Odyssey. It's good to see you again.
That's a great pick. So I'm going to like BuzzFeed blast you now with a list of mine. Because I could have gone one of 20 different ways with this, and I wouldn't have any regrets about those picks. But King Kong, like the original King Kong, The Thing, obviously. Nightmare on Elm Street, Raiders of the Lost Ark,
of course.
That big polystyrene ball that's chasing him. American Werewolf in London.
And that's still horrific.
There's the chestburster scene in Alien.
Too terrifying.
What it must have been like to experience one of those movies for the first time without the ubiquity of trailers or the internet or sort of like 10 ways explaining what this scene means. Mm. To just go in completely blind, hearing that there's something you have to see in that film, and just experiencing the chestburster and how that must have melted heads at that time.
And when what I love about the filmmaking there is that, again, they knew that how shocking it was when they were shooting that. So the actors knew something was going to happen, but didn't know exactly how it was going to happen. Or
it's so clever.
So the reaction they captured on camera is a very real reaction, you know, from the performers. And again, it's about reality. It's about, you know, engineering a kind of a real tangible thing.
Yeah, yeah.
A good side effect of practical effects is you get good performances. You get more real performances.
Okay, so you've got The Exorcist. Yeah.
Fuck this.
Fuck. The bed levitating.
The power of Christ compels you.
Oh, does it? Does it compel me?
The power of Christ compels you.
The power of Christ compelling me? Is that what's happening?
The power of Christ compels you.
Guess what? It's not that compelling.
The old age makeup on Max von Sydow. I mean, that's a special effect in itself.
How old was he? Like, was he a lot younger?
I think he was in his 30s, but they matched it so well that, wow. You know, you look at that now and you think that Max von Sydow was always in his 70s.
Yeah, that's actually what I had the illusion. I grew up thinking Max von Sydow has been old for a long time.
You know, he has.
Just grew into that makeup. Wow.
And now he's the oldest he's ever been. He's dead.
Oh, yeah.
Poltergeist, Ghostbusters, Close Encounters, Blade Runner, The Flying Cars, Lord of the Rings. Yeah. You know, the forced perspective stuff with the hobbits, where they made them look really small.
Yeah, that was going to be one of my picks. I love the forced perspective stuff. That, for me, is real magic. I love that. You know, selling this scale and selling this world. But
I will say, though, the one special effect in that film that I hate are those disgusting hairy feet that the hobbits wear. So creepy.
Yeah, they're pretty. Couldn't they just shave them?
So, this was difficult for me because it's like, do you go the route of picking like what you consider to be objectively the best that nobody else is going to have any issues with? Or do you go the subjective route and go with the one which affected you most? And I really, as I say, couldn't pick. Mm-hmm. So I did a phone a friend thing, like Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, and called in our very first guest expert. So I called Dan Martin, who is a special effects designer, and he's worked on films like Possessor and Color Out of Space, and he's currently up for a Chainsaw Award. Well, he's up for two at the moment, so fingers crossed for that. But I called Dan, so I wanted to pick Dan's brains, and I'm going to play for you now my interview with Dan. So Dan, I have never interviewed anyone before, and in order to do this, I sort of looked up sort of questions that were online. So my first question to you is, tell me about a time when you've demonstrated leadership. And the second part of that question is, what do you consider to be your greatest strengths?
I think that it probably doesn't work in my favour every time. But the way in which I have demonstrated strong leadership is that I don't have a filter and so will suggest mad shit to directors. And sometimes it means producers hate me because I'm basically pitching for work that they hadn't budgeted for. And sometimes it's like just crazy shit on the last minute at set, like on set at the last minute. I'll be like, oh, what if we did this? And then everyone fucking hates me because I've just added some time to the day. But
you worked on Human Centipede 2?
Yes.
Obviously, there were no practical effects on that film, but what was it like shooting it?
Well, I mean, like any documentary, it's always very hard not to intervene.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, it was, you know, it was mad.
Was it smelly?
It was, well, it was, but not in the way that you'd expect. I was in charge of, among other things, making up all of the fake shit, and that had to be food grade. Because it was going in mouths.
Oh,
And so I was using a modification of the recipe that Pasolini developed for his film Salo, 120 Days of Sodom.
Wow.
And as you can probably guess, there's a lot of chocolate in that. So actually, the whole set smelt... There's chocolate and marmalade in it. So the whole set smelt like a Terry's chocolate orange. The two difficult things when you're dealing with fake shit on set is, one, convincing people to eat it, and two, getting them to stop eating it when they've found out how delicious it is.
Oh, there we go.
There you go.
This week, I am doing best practical effects, and obviously I watch these things as an audience member, and I don't really have the expertise to sort of judge these things on a technical level, but I was wondering what it is that you look for in a great practical effects scene. Seeing as that's the realm in which you work.
Absolutely. I mean, it's very hard to pinpoint it just because it's such a broad field. There are so many things that count as practical effects, whether it's prosthetic makeup effects or, like, you know, environmental effects, scenic, camera trickery. All of those things kind of, like, work together. And so when you first asked me to do this, I put together like a long list of things that came to mind, whether they were formative for me or things that I loved or things that like made a huge difference to the way I saw effects and film effects. But to be honest, as far as like perfection in camera practical effects goes, it's got to be the head operation in Terminator 2.
Isn't that a deleted scene as well? It's not actually in the film.
It's definitely in a version of the film, but by this point, I've got so many versions of that movie, and I've seen it so many times, yeah. I kind of forget what's in what version.
Rotate the two locking cylinders counterclockwise.
Yeah, it's one of those great deleted scenes, but that's an incredible one. That's sort of like using the isn't it Linda Hamilton's twin sister?
Hamilton's twin sister, who also features very heavily in the T-1000 sequence at the end when he's pretending to be Sarah Connor. But yeah, that shot in Terminator 2 when she's pulling the chip out of Arnie's head, and it's an over-shoulder shot. It starts off as a close-up on the skull with her rootling around inside the head, like way deeper than you could do with a traditional prosthetic. And then the camera pulls up a little bit and tilts, and it becomes an over-shoulder two-shot of them in the mirror, but over their shoulders. And it's done with the real Linda Hamilton and Arnold Schwarzenegger in a reverse-built version of the set on the other side of a window dressed to look like a mirror in a fake wall, with Linda Hamilton's sister playing the back of Sarah Connor and a puppet playing Arnie's head for the operation in the foreground. And it's unfucking believable.
I was listening to Will Wisher on a podcast just recently, and he was talking about that being one of his favourite scenes, and he was really disappointed when it got cut because it sort of signifies this transition as well for John, which says, like, if you won't listen to me, how do you expect the rest of the world to take me seriously if I'm supposed to be this great new leader?
Look, Mom, if I'm ever supposed to be this great military leader, maybe you should start listening to my leadership ideas once in a while. So my own mother won't. How do you expect anyone else to?
But they caught it for time.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so I'd say that's perfection. But as far as things that, like... So I got into special effects before I really got into film. Like, I didn't have a lot of access to film as a kid. My mum had a very sort of authoritarian opinion of my access to television. So I'd see, like, TV shows and cartoons and stuff around friends' houses, but I'd see very few films. I went to the cinema a few times. Labyrinth was obviously a big deal for me. But like as far as horror stuff goes, which was very much what I was drawn to in my youth, it was more about reference books. My school library had a big, thick book on monsters in film that I'd sort of look through and I was obsessed with, and I'd photocopy pages out of it and take them home and all that kind of stuff. So I'd seen stills of a lot of this stuff before I'd ever seen the movies. And then when I got to see the films, I was already like going as hard and fast as I could at getting this stuff because my only access to it was semi-illicit anyway, because it was without the consent of my parents.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that immediately fell me into the group, like, you know, threw me into the social groups who were trading like the video nasties and all that kind of stuff. So I saw these amazing movies that a lot of my my direct contemporaries at that point in my life had no idea existed. And so I was seeing these amazing things. Like the very first thing that came into my head when you asked me was Ruggero Deodato's Cut and Run from 1985. Mm. I mean, that's a, like, you know, Deodato, probably most famous for Cannibal Holocaust. Cut and Run tread some of the same territory. It's, you know, still, like, a lot of it's set in the jungle. He made it 5-6 years later. It does a dual narrative between the urban jungle crime and the actual jungle. But it has a scene in it that was lifted wholesale for Bone Tomahawk a few years ago.
Oh, God almighty.
Well, that scene...
sequence is horrendous.
That scene comes from Cut and Run, and if you can imagine me, you know, in 1985, I mean, obviously not quite 1985, I didn't see it, I didn't go to the premiere or anything, but you know, I got hold of this like bootleg VHS that had this grainy effect in it, and it like my jaw was on the floor. It's like, fuck, okay, so we're allowed to do this kind of thing, like this is within the realm of special effects. And I've never seen anything like it at that point.
There seems to be this sort of running thread through a lot of people that work in the industry and do what we do, but it seems to be being warped at an early age.
Yeah.
Just the power of cinema sort of gets hooked into you, and you sort of, you're drawn to it. It's like, I want to do that, that dangerous, exciting, magical thing that's on screen that is just causing all these emotions in me.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, I can imagine that blowing your mind.
When I was young, one of the three VHS cassettes we had in the house, we had an Asterix movie, a series of short films set to opera music, and then my parents had a copy of Peter Greenaway's The Cook, the Thief, His Wife and Her Lover. And I would set my alarm.
Did you watch any kids' films, Dan?
Very few. I'd set my alarm clock for 3 a.m. when I knew my parents would be asleep, and I'd go downstairs and I'd watch The Cook, the Thief, His Wife and Her Lover like 3 or 4 times a week for months.
Oh my God. That'll do it. That'll rewire your brain.
I love that film. I still love that film.
So what sort of what sort of turns you off, I suppose, in a practical effects scene? Like, because I think people are very hard on CG effects in films. We sort of can tell when it's sort of floaty and it doesn't work. We're much more forgiving of practical effects. Like, you can tell that that's a man in a suit, or it's there's something about it. There's a weight to it and a visceralness of it that we forgive it.
Yeah, it's that even if it's not the thing it's purporting to be, it's still real. It's still a tangible thing.
Yeah.
And that's why, like, if VFX fails even slightly, with CGI specifically, but if CGI fails even slightly, then it's not real.
You just know it's all pretend.
I mean, genuinely, there's full artifice. And you don't even need to be able to recognize exactly why it doesn't work. Like, the layperson might not know that the blacks haven't been matched properly, or that, like, you know, there's a matte line around something. They may not be able to specify exactly what the problem is, but... their brain goes, well, I don't like this. This is not correct.
It's like that scene in Nightmare on Elm Street where Freddy's tongue sticks out of the phone into Nancy's mouth. And you can tell it's a rubber tongue, but just the fact that something has gone into a mouth just makes you sort of recoil.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the thing is that when you're dealing with something tangible, with something real, then the uncanny works in your favor for special effects. But when you're working in the realm of animation, digital animation specifically purporting to be real, then the uncanny will throw you out of a scene.
Yeah.
Like, I still get a huge amount of enjoyment from very bad special effects.
Yeah, there's sort of a playfulness to it. It's sort of, you're seeing somebody's imagination on screen. Somebody has made that.
Yeah.
I remember seeing the behind-the-scenes footage of The Thing, and the actors talking about, they used to love going down to the workshop to see this sort of grotesque but beautiful creations that Rob Bottin was making.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Bottin was on my list as well. The 180 degree radial track headshot in RoboCop.
You probably don't think I'm a very nice guy, do you?
Buddy, I think you're slime.
Is another example of an amazingly brave and well thought out special effect.
Give the man a hand.
He's already been shot a bunch of times. He's lost limbs. He's very almost dead anyway. And it's just before the headshot that kills him. And it starts on his face, and he's rocking back and forward, screaming in pain. It starts on his face, and it does a 180 radial track around behind him until it's behind Murphy, shooting across him off to Boudicca. And Boudicca fires his gun, and the back of Murphy's head blows out, and he falls over.
Okay, let's get out of here.
But again, it blows out in with real depth, a way you could never do with an actual actor. And at the time, I don't think I realised it, but it's a puppet. Murphy, you know, is never, the actor's never in that shot. It's even at the beginning when you're on his face, like nowadays you'd start, you know, someone would probably start on an actor and they'd hide a transition to the puppet in the radial move. They'd put in a hidden edit. But Bettine, incredibly bold, has a full expressive puppet. He knows exactly what the limits of his materials are, and he presents something that works incredibly well. I think still stands up today, and you get this amazing shot, but you're so like in the moment at that point anyway, you don't think for a second that that's not a real person.
No, you just feel it. You can just...
Yeah,
you can,
absolutely. I mean, I will say that I had a conversation with someone about head explosions in like general the other day, and I said all the best head explosions you've seen were done with a shotgun rather than with a belt. Like that one and the one that Savini did for Lustig's Maniac, where Savini cameos in the car and he's with a woman in the car. Savini's playing the guy, so Savini has life cast himself to play, you know, for the exploding head. Joe Spinell, who's playing the maniac, jumps up onto the bonnet of the car, loses his footing and falls off with a loaded shotgun, which, you know, you can just about see him losing his footing in one of those shots. They're shooting this in New York, where you're not allowed shotguns. Like, it's a no-shotgun state. So, you know, they're breaking the law. They get all the preamble stuff, and then they're like, okay, so we're going to do it, we're ready. And they fire the shotgun for real through the windscreen of the car into this fake head that Tom Savini has filled with fake blood and clam chowder. The second they go, we got it, the gun goes in the back of one car. They drive all off in different directions. They abandon the car with this blown up body in the seat in a lockup for several days to make sure they're not going to get got by the police when they go and pick it up. And then they go and pick it up, you know, a week later, full of rotten summer heat clam chowder.
So really what I'm sort of picking up from this is that great practical effects don't have to be invisible, you know, the way that CGI effects, when they really are successful, you don't sort of notice them. But a great practical effect scene, you remember it, you feel it. And even if it's got sort of like little flaws about it or things where you can go, well, that's not real, that's fake. The fact that it's so well done and executed, it's like you go to a magic show and you know that the magician is doing tricks, that it's not really happening, but it's the trick. Yeah, it's the but it's the fact that it still wows you and you don't know how they did it, that it sort of it leaves that impression on you.
Well, it's appropriate that you make that connection, because I was a magic nerd before I was an effects nerd, and effects owes a huge debt to magic. The origins,
all those forced perspective silent era stuff,
exactly. But even like the old double exposure stuff, where Méliès would like run across screen with a black bag on his head and then rewind the film and run across screen with a black suit on, but it'd stop halfway so it looked like he carried on and the head stopped.
There's an incredible transformation in a black and white film, and I forget the name of it now, but it's a woman that turns into a crone.
You're the actor,
and it's stunning.
It's a legitimate special effect. So they filmed through a piece of gradiated glass, which had a colour, like a colour filter on it, like filming through one lens of a pair of 3D glasses. And the actress had two lots of makeup on. Obviously, this could only be done in black and white. She had a, let's say, red and green. Uh-huh. I don't know for certain that it was red and green. But she had one set of, like a beauty makeup in red and a crone makeup in green. And so when you film through a red lens, you only see the green makeup.
Oh.
And then as you slide the glass across and it transitions from green to red, then you see the other makeup instead.
That's ingenious. The fact that they were coming up with that back then, it's incredible.
Absolutely brilliant.
What's the thing, Dan? I'm curious. What's the thing that you wish audiences, but also like filmmakers, you know, because sometimes you're working with, you know, first-time filmmakers or people that don't have as much sort of experience doing or using practical effects. What's the one thing that you wish people knew in general about what it is that you do?
I don't know. I mean, I'm not like for the audience. I'm happy for them to go in the dark. Like it, like you said, it's like a magic trick, and the less you know about it, and you know, obviously, I undermine this somewhat by talking constantly, but and for example having just explained how you do an effect, but I do think that often not knowing, I mean, with gore effects and horror effects, often the, oh my goodness, I can't believe I just saw that moment is as valuable. Like, the concept is as valuable as the execution. As far as working with, like, first-time directors go, just that it's going to take time.
Yeah.
Like, not just on set either. Like, to be honest, the more experienced you get, the less time it takes on set, because the more you have figured out how to have, like, soak up all that time in pre-production. But that things are going to take time ahead of time, and that one, what might seem like a tiny change is never a tiny change.
Will I tell you where my head is at, and yeah, see what you think of this being like my favourite scene in a movie, a practical effects scene? So I was thinking it would be just blowing my mind as a kid. But that's where my head is at. What do you think of that? Does that sort of like feel like a basic choice? Because so far, all my choices on this podcast have been basic.
I mean, I think that there's, with film, there isn't really a thing, such a thing as basic. Like, I, you know, maybe with writing or with like a director choice, you can, like, not you personally, but one can have a preference that betrays a lack of like maybe a broader experience. But actually, I think with something like this, it's so like they're so impactful, it's so it's so much about the moment, that that's a perfectly valid choice. I'm not expecting you to turn up and bust out like to run you through some others on my long list.
Go for it. Yeah, definitely
the triple impaling from Toshihara Kida's Evil Dead Trap from 1988.
Deep cut.
Which was done by Shinichi Osaka, who was like, he made Godzilla suits and did loads of kaiju movies. He was like a great Japanese effects artist. But then he also did...
See, I thought those Godzilla suits looked very fake, Dan.
Some of the... Like, you go back to the beginning, obviously, they're a little clumsy. But one of the things I love about that franchise is watching them refine the processes. Watching them get better at miniatures, watching them get better at miniature photography.
Until Roland Emmerich perfected it.
Absolutely, yeah. Who knew that what Godzilla was missing all along was a cloaca?
Exactly.
You got two from Argento films, which blew me away when I was younger. You've got the arm coming off in Tenebrae from 75. And then you've got the needles under the eyes from Opera in 87.
Oh,
the
horrible.
Like to stop her from blinking while her boyfriend sort of executed.
Yeah.
And the, again.
How did they do that? Well, they literally had needles in their eyes, didn't they?
Yes, but, and I was about to say, and you know, once you've seen it, like, you know exactly how it's done, but evidently, so those shots are flipped. The tape is on the top eyelid, and it's not stuck to the eyelid, it's stuck just past the eye, so that the actress can blink, and it doesn't move the needles, but they just edited out all the blinks and flipped the footage.
Oh, okay.
So if you look, the corners of the eyes curve off the bottom, the tear ducts curve off.
That's brilliant. Listen, Dan, this was my phone a friend sort of like guest expert opinion, and you've definitely come through for me. So I'm going to go back to Will now and
thank you, mum,
and drop some knowledge on him.
And tell him he's got to watch Evil Dead Trap.
Definitely. That's right up Will Street, I can tell you. Thanks a million, Dan.
Thanks, mum.
I love Dan. Dan should be like our third co-host.
He's great. He's really great. Oh,
Terminator 2 as well. I was surprised that he came up with that. I thought it was going to be some sort of like creature effect.
It's a great pick as well.
Which is a trick shot as well. It's like using mirrors and stuff.
It's a fantastic effect. And it's one of those moments when you see it done, when you see it like the execution of it. And it really just boggles your mind. You go, wow.
I love that he mentioned RoboCop. Oh. That's one of those films which, when I think back on it, I think like, what was I watching? That is probably the most violent film that I'd seen as a kid that felt like it was marketed towards me, because he's still called RoboCop. It was a cartoon when I was a kid. But
Kevin, man, listen to me. I'll quickly tell you about my experience with RoboCop. I remember going into my local video library on a Friday night, and in the new release section, there in front of me was like a amazing looking cover for this really cool superhero called RoboCop for $150, and I took it home, and I just thought it was just like a cool superhero dude. And this was going to be one of my picks for effects, actually. When we got to the scene in the boardroom where they're introducing ED-209, the kind of like the pre-RoboCop version. The executive hands a gun, tells a junior executive to point a gun at ED-209, and oh my god, ED-209 just blasts him, and they must have put 100 squibs into that actor, and my brain was just melted as well. I truly believe that I watched the director's cut of that film because it went on far too long. It went on way, way too long. And I was just traumatized by that scene.
Do you know what my favorite special effect, though, is in RoboCop? It's when the head of OCP falls out the window.
Oh, and he's got long arms. He's got long arms.
He's got the big long arms. Goofy. You're thinking, that is rubbish. Turn it off. I don't want to watch anymore.
It was the end of the film, so you were lucky. It was going the worst effect is the last one.
It's crap.
And it's still, if you watch the director's cut, I still think that is quite potent, even though you can see the kind of the rubberiness of the effects, but it's real, it's on camera, and the actual RoboCop suit is amazing, and how they did that, and it just looks cool. And anyway, I could talk all day about RoboCop. Love it. It's great.
Excuse me, Robo, any special message for all the kids watching at home?
Dead or alive, you are coming with me.
It must be so hard to act against like a tennis ball or what have you. I remember being on the set of Grabbers, and obviously we didn't build a 35-foot, intergalactic octopus, but it was...
No way.
We built some of the smaller ones, but I remember we were in... we were outside in a Baltic winter. It was absolutely freezing. That was the time when airports were closed because of the snow. It was unheard of at the time. In fact, we lost days of the production because of snowfall. And we never got them back, but I remember being on set and, we had the ray machines going and it was freezing.
Wow.
And, Richard Coyle, who played O'Shea, the protagonist of the film, was, standing out there at midnight with the ray machines going down on him. And he was saying the eye line, where's the eye line? And somebody had to run back in and say, it's there and point, and then he had to look up and pretend that this thing was coming towards him, and so I can just imagine how difficult it is for actors to sort of create the world in your head rather than responding to what's in front of you, because that's what great acting is, isn't it? It's like reacting, but when you are having to create the thing that you have to react to, you're slightly inside your own head, you're not naturally bouncing off something.
Yeah, it's a very... It was actually, again, connecting back into Roger Rabbit last week, they complimented Bob Hoskins because once you have a physical object to focus your eye line on, let's say if you put your hand out in front of your face, your eye line can focus on your hand. But as soon as you take away your hand, your eye focus is going to go to the far wall. But Bob Hoskins managed to hold his focus. He managed to do it. He was an incredible performer and he really sold that. He was just excellent.
Yeah. I think he nearly had a breakdown doing that film as well, didn't he?
Now, Roger is his name. Laughter is his cane. Come on, you dope, untie his rope and watch him go insane.
Well, I wouldn't blame him.
So, I'm sort of dancing around the houses here because I feel that I would be denying my DNA if I didn't mention this film. Because of all the films I've ever mentioned on this podcast, this is the one where the minute that a scene suggestion comes up, I immediately go through the Rolodex in my mind of thinking, can I mention this film? Can I mention this one? Because it's the one that, without question, and some people are going to roll their eyes at this and it's kind of naff, but without question, if this film didn't exist or if I didn't see this film at the time that I saw it, I wouldn't have become a screenwriter at all. I wouldn't have had the love affair with film. This abusive love affair with film, it means so much to me that if people criticize the film, even if I can understand where they're coming from, it hurts me. It makes me feel a bit don't do that. It's such a lovely, joyous, wonderful film. You can't criticize it. That's not fair. That's like kicking a puppy.
I'm so curious.
But it is the film that means the most to me, and the one that is my go-to sort of comfort watch. That I've got a handful of them. Midnight Run is another but the one that I sort of like tried to save up and use on special occasions is 1978's Richard Donner's Superman the Movie.
Say, Jim, boom!
Excuse me.
That's a bad outfit!
Brilliant. Oh, I'm so glad you picked that. I'm so glad you picked that.
You believe a man can fly is what they said.
God, look up there.
What the hell is that?
Easy, miss. I've got you.
You've got me? Who's got you?
I can't believe it. I just cannot believe it. He got her.
But the reason that I sort of like love that film so much is that, and the reason why it sort of it means so much to me is that I was an only child, and when my parents were divorcing, I was brought up in England. And when I left England, I went to Ireland with my mom, and I went to Cork. And this is in the sort of mid to late 80s, when the relations between Ireland and the UK were very testy. And I obviously had an English accent, and I felt like an alien myself. And also, I used to wear my underpants outside my clothes, and I don't know why people were like throwing rocks at me. But I would sort of lose myself in movies, but especially Superman the Movie. And for some reason, just that movie just became the elixir and the balm that just made me feel happy. And to this day, when I'm writing something, I try to tap into what that film did for me, that sort of that joy that it gave me, and write for that kid, that other kid that's out there that is sitting down and needs that sort of escape and needs that sort of injected into their veins.
Who are you?
A friend.
Bye. Christopher Reeve, he was a special effect himself. That one shot where he first, when he's in the Fortress of Solitude and he takes off, you know, it's a long shot. And he takes off, and it's just one shot. It's a locked-in shot, and he flies.
Colin Chilvers, who was the guy that won the Academy Award for that, he was like the creative supervisor and the director of special effects on it. He said, you know, because they filmed the first two films back-to-back, so they were filming for about 18 months. This was like Lord of the Rings style.
Wow.
They were constantly dealing with technical issues, but they did that shot, and it was that moment of Christopher Reeve banking as he flew out of the Fortress of Solitude, and it just lifted everybody's spirits, and from that moment on they felt like renewed to sort of carry the film home.
It's fulfilling the promise of the movie tagline, you know, you'll believe a man can fly. And when he takes off, it was a lot of effort and a lot of engineering to really figure out how to create the illusion of Christopher Reeve Superman flying, and that one shot sells it. That one shot today, still today, is magic.
But it's not my pick.
Oh.
I chose for my favourite special effects scene in all of movie history, there was only one choice really, and it is the three-titted woman from Total Recall.
The tree boobed.
I thought that was incredible, and it's still, I think about it still to this day.
I'm sure you do.
It's like, how did they do it?
And why did evolution require a third breast?
They're all connected. What the fuck?
What was evolution?
And why did I put it there and not like underneath the other one? It just seems a bit awkward. No, my pick gave us a master filmmaker. It gave him free reign, and he has given us so many classics. When I think about magic happening on set, when I think about difficulty in pulling something off, it is one of the greatest villains in all of movie history. The one, the only, the almighty Jaws.
You went with Bruce from Jaws. Oh my God.
I did. And the scene that I went with is the famous scene.
Shark!
It's the first time that the shark appears on camera where we get to see him.
Now what?
Michael's in the pond.
And it's a pivotal scene in the movie because it's the moment when Brody, who's our protagonist, is coming face to face with his own failings as a man. you know, from the first scene, he pegs it straight away and it says it's a shark attack. But he comes to Amity to make a difference, but he lacks conviction and he doesn't follow through on his gut instincts. So he can't really be much of a hero if he doesn't do the thing that he knows to be right. And it's in that moment, you know, it's the most crucial moment for me in screenwriting, is the midpoint. It's when, as we say in screenwriting terms, it's the point of no return where the character, the protagonist, can never go back to their old world. It's like things have changed now and they've changed fundamentally. And it's at that moment where that's when we get our first visual of the shark itself, when it kills the instructor. And it comes inches within taking his own son.
He's dead.
No, he's not. He's in shock.
And it's after that moment where, you know, Brody does that slow look out to the ocean, and he knows that even as a man who's afraid of the water, he has to go out there and he has to face his greatest fears. Because otherwise, he won't make a difference.
The shark works so well, or the effect of the shark works so well, when we kind of get all these shadowy kind of like suggestions of just how big and just how fierce it is. You know, another example is like the buoys that they shoot into its skin, and they just like pop up out of the ocean to indicate that it's there. And like, it's a practical effect, but it's obviously a cut around. It's like the actual shark didn't work, so they had to say, well, how can we actually get around not having the shark that doesn't work?
This is where you know that is a fake shark, and they even make that joke of it in Back to the Future 2, where it's like the shark still looks fake. But the shark looks fake, but the shark is there and you feel it.
I think you're absolutely right. And that's the key thing. And it kind of taps into a primordial fear in us. And in those shots where it's moving, and you can see the shape of it, it is moving under the water, it triggers something in us, and it just really bloody works.
When you think of like special effects scenes, that is the one which is probably the hardest to pull off. Building like a 25-foot model, sinking it in the New England ocean, and getting it to work with the weather and the ocean currents and what have you. It's remarkable what they pulled off.
Smile, you son of a bitch!
There we go. So now I got to spin the wheel for you, Will, and figure out what your scene's going to be for next week.
You know what I just remembered? I have a veto in my back pocket here. It's just burning a hole in my pocket.
Okay, skip week.
Yeah. So I'm just not recording a podcast next week.
I'll bring Dan back. Dan's my favorite.
Dan, watch yourself. Kevin's all mine. Back off, Dan.
Okay. Here we go.
Thanks, Dan. Thanks, Dan.
Spinning the wheel.
Appreciate it.
And it is... Oh, this is a really weird one.
Okay.
It's best... it's best Alan Smithy scene.
Okay. So, what? Alan Smithy scene? So the nom de plume of the director who's taken his name off the film.
That's the name that people use when they don't want to be associated with the film because the film is so bad that the director wants to take their name off it.
But you know what? That should be... You know, actually, you know, sometimes when you get... sometimes when you get the topic you want to get, you go. It's actually a nightmare because there's too much to pick from. But then when you get a topic that you really go, I don't know what to do with that, it actually turns out to be great because there's a very limited number of films to pick from. And it's kind of interesting. I love the fact that I haven't got a clue where I'm going with this. And this is going to be fun. This is
okay. Will, where can people find you? And where can people find us?
People can find me and us on Twitter mainly. I'm under Willems Film, WillumsFilm. And we're also under the Best Bits Pod. Isn't that right, Kevin? Isn't that us on Twitter?
That's right. And I'm on Twitter under at Kevin Lehan. But also, for all those that are listening and that are enjoying the podcast so far, rate us and review us on your podcast provider of choice, because it really, really helps us get the word out about the podcast. And it sort of like triggers the algorithms, and then it gets recommended to other people. So if you're enjoying it, share the podcast with those that you think might like it as well. Doing us a huge favor. And so until next week.
Until next
best
week.
Alan Smithy scene.
Alan Smithy. I'm going to interview Alan Smithy for next week. I'm gonna find a random Alan Smithy in a non-existent phone book and call him and say, so you have an interesting catalogue.
Well, I am great at impressions, so if you need me to pretend to be Alan Smithy, okay, just say the word.
Okay. Oh, daddy boy. Yeah. The pipes are calling.
The Best Bits podcast is produced by Will and Kevin.
All audio clips and music heard in this episode is the intellectual property of the respective copyright holders, and no infringement is intended.
If you enjoyed this episode, please like, share, subscribe, rate, review, all that good stuff.
If you have any notes, comments, scene suggestions, or just want to get in touch with us, email us at bestbitspodcast@gmail.com.
And here is a clip from the lads' latest Mini Bits bonus show. The full episode, plus 100 more, are available on their Patreon.
Mini Bits.
Another new episode.
Patreon podcast.
Of this Patreon podcast. Exclusive.
The Best Bits podcast with Will and Ken. Bonus content.
Kevin, how are you?
Hi, honey. How are you?
Oh, you know, I've got this. I've got my corns sorted out. I went to the chiropodist the other day, and she
Your
said,
"Corn,
my corns. Did you ever get corns?
No.
Did you know what a corn is?
Yeah, it's a bunion on your foot, isn't it?
Yeah, like in between your toes and stuff like that.
Do you not wear any shoes like around the house? You walk barefoot.
No, it's the opposite.
GA shorts.
It's the opposite. I wear incredibly tight shoes. Like those Chinese women who get their feet bound, who had their feet bound, like, you know, before the turn of this last century. And so they had incredible corns and bunions. This is a great opener for a Mini Bits episode where we get people disgusted.
Squally, it's episode 73 of the Mini Bits. I'm Kevin, you're Will. This is our Patreon podcast. Thank you to all our lovely patrons. Yeah. A few of you have jumped in recently. I don't know what we said. We try to goad people into joining up every single episode, and then every so often it's like a lot of people join because of one specific episode, and I'm like, how did we say on that episode that's different to the other 270 episodes?
Maybe it didn't sound as desperate. Maybe we said don't join. Maybe reverse psychology. That's how we should do it. Reverse psychology. Don't join up to our patron. Don't.
Cancel. Everybody cancel.
You don't deserve to be in this group. We don't want you. We don't like the look of you.
We don't need anybody.
It's just us. It's absolutely just us. Hey, should we tell you, we did, I don't know, maybe we shouldn't say it on mic, especially so early. We did an interview with the Irish Examiner last Friday.
We did.
Yeah.
And
How do you think I did?
I think you did all right. Like, you didn't interrupt me once, so I was delighted with how I came across. But, you know, there's no sort of time limit on this. We don't know when it's going to get posted. One of our friends was saying, Kathy at the cinema was saying that their interview with, did they do The Examiner as well? It was six months before it posted.
And The Guardian, I'm pretty sure. They were profiled in The Guardian as well.
Yeah, but we don't do any really promotion. Like, we don't do anything.
Well, this is our first time getting any sort of like proper coverage, which is going to be mad. So listen to all you listeners who have found us before we explode. You're an OG. You're an OG listener before Kevin starts getting gold chains from all his Patreon dash.
I think I'm more of a silver than a gold. I think my undertones suit more silver. But
I just want to die.
Goes with my Prince Albert.
Your hat?
Yeah.
I want one of those diamond studs in my tooth. That's all I want. So I can go bing whenever I'm on a call.
Oh, yeah.
Bing.
I usually just, you know, wink and that glints.
Yeah.
Like a starlight twinkle.
Speaking of which, I interrupted you. What did you want to speak of? Which?
Start the timer.
Oh! I forgot.
You may as well.
start the timer.
All these looky-loos are listening in and they're wondering, what are we going to be talking about? But we have to start talking about them after.
Yeah.
We say goodbye. But look, I wanted to talk to you about, well, you've seen a few things. You've seen the new Godzilla film.
Yes.
I've seen the first Omen. I saw Scoop as well.
We're looking Netflix forward to watching this. We already see, okay.
Okay. I'll save my thoughts. And what else did I see? I made notes, but sure, it doesn't really matter.
I think I saw it.
And I was going to go through all the summer releases and see what takes your fancy.
Okay. I'm looking forward because I don't actually know what's on the horizon. So
the Joker 2 trailer came out today.
I saw it. Yes, I watched that.
Mm-hmm. It reminded me of Chicago.
Yeah, it's kind of like you see it's all very much in the mind's eye. They're calling it a jukebox musical. Am I right in saying that?
I think you're right in saying that.
So, look, hey, listen. What it did remind me of was that I want to rewatch The Joker because I saw it in the cinema and I thought it was fine. It was kind of a bold new direction.
I'm just going to go back and watch the episodes from the Batman 66 show, the Joker episodes.
Oh, yeah, that's going
to
be...
Just to fill me in, on the lore. You know, get up to speed.
Get you right up to speed. And you'll be there going, where are all the guys in the purple suits with the masks? When are they going to show up? And
it's a weird time, though, where we have the Penguin TV show with Colin Farrell coming out, which is a totally different canon version of the Penguin. Then you have this offshoot of Joker, which is its own universe entirely.
Mm.
And then you have the old Batman films that you can watch.
Right.
And, I don't know where I'm going with this, but it's just, I don't know. I'm kind There's of so many IP.
But like,
it's just everywhere.
What's happened is the comic book world has very much entered the film world. It's where you could have different runs, totally different runs of a character by it's different insane. Authors. And there'd be totally different riffs on it and stuff. Oh, this is the thing. Kevin, so I'm only catching up on this. You mentioned it to me on a podcast. Was it on one of those show?
It was the last mini bits.
You said everyone's describing stuff as insane recently.
And have you started noticing it though?
Only with people trying to rise you. That's the only place where I've noticed people on Discord are trying to rise you.
Oh my God. Oh my God. I could start posting now tweets, comments, TikToks, articles, anything. Insane is everywhere. This is insane. That's insane. It's insane. There was a festival just going on about this insane lineup. I was like, oh, it's a mentally ill lineup. Okay. it's everywhere. And the other thing that's also bothering me lately?
Wow.
And this has been bothering me for years and years and years. It used to be that everyone used to misspell definitely. They'd go defiantly.
Okay.
Oh, it's defiantly whatever. It would just, they're morons. But no, I just keep noticing everyone keeps spelling a lot as one word, A-L-O-T, a lot. Where have they gotten into their heads that a lot is one word? It's the same way that people will write every time as one word.
What's the one that you've pulled me up on a few times and I can't get it right? Compliment.
Compliment.
I can't, but I can't get it right. It's like the
I. Because I told you the other day.
Yeah, and I went searching for it and I couldn't find it because I had to use it.
If there's an I in compliment, it's I'm paying you a compliment.
That's a good way to remember it. Okay, good. And then compliment.
I wrote that to you.
But you did, and I went to try and find it because I found myself writing the word compliments. And I went, shit, Kevin.
But you gave me a thumbs up, which meant in my world that, yeah, I read that. Thanks.
But I did, right? I'm talking about a couple of days later when I was faced with the exact same hurdle of writing the word compliment. I went, okay, what did Kevin say again about compliment? There's an I and the E. What did he say? So I went searching for it and I found it, I think. And I went, the I is paying me a compliment or I'm giving you
it's
a compliment.
It's insane how little you can retain information. It's insane.
Come here, let's start talking about what we watched. Come on.
Did you start the timer?
Yeah, it's gone. It's ticking. It's ticking down. The world's going to explode.
You know, I have to put in the sound effect. I have to line up all my sound effects.
When you said start the timer,
I have a whole soundboard. Okay. Jesus Christ, where's my fucking...
What?
Where's my ding-dang-ding?
Here we go. The timer has started. There we go.
There we go. Yeah. Right.
Okay!